Next on the list is Richard Petty Carr. Years ago, I used to enjoy heckling him when he spoke on other platforms than ours. I'm very proud and delighted in the last few years that he's associated himself with the socialist movement and he's speaking for us tonight.
The first casualty when war comes is truth. Say, how many of you know Senator Hiram Johnson? Very well known, in 1917. The validity of this statement is demonstrated in the accounts of war both before and since that statement was made. Though, of course, it would be dangerously foolish to assume that truth is regarded as a sacred vessel in any area of politics. Nevertheless, we can be sure that the official versions of almost every battle ever fought, from the Armada to the Alamo, and before and since, are seldom more than glorified fiction. How many, even of this audience, I wonder, and especially those of you with A-level history, know that in fact only one Spanish ship was actually sunk in Drake's heroic victory? Not many. And that thousands of English ships, sailors, were prevented from embarking after their heroic victory and left to die as prisoners on the ships they served, so that they would not have to be paid. Or that many of the Spanish ships were unable to fire their cannonballs, which were supplied from Italy, because they were too large to go into the battle. If only I'd read all these things at school, how much more keen I would have been to get into the history book. Indeed, how many of you know, and how many of you seen it in the papers, not over here you ain't, that when the mighty American flagship Wisconsin sailed into the Gulf a few weeks ago, it was actually forbidden to fire its guns, even in practice. And this was not for any humanitarian consideration, but because over a year ago, scientists at the Sandia National Laboratories found a flaw in the gunpowder bag, which was probably the cause of a fatal accident which occurred on a similar ship the year before on the island. Latest reports, which I have today, say that the ban on firing will be lifted imminently. Well, I'm sure that's a relief for the bloody crew. Tragically, the history of warfare is riddled with own goals, and modern warfare more than any. It is also riddled with dubious justifications for continuing to expand the production and sales of armaments. Two particularly offensive ones, the first relating to nuclear weapons and the second to general sales, are, and you've all heard these, they've kept the peace for 45 years, and if we don't sell them, others will. The idea that there has been peace for several decades, astonishingly, still a widely held opinion, is especially gross. During the 25-year period between 1960 and 1985, 81 major wars have been fought, in which 13 million people have been killed. In that same period, $15 trillion was spent for military purposes, and things are scarcely improving. In 1987, more wars were fought than in any previous year in recorded history. And mark this well, 4/5 of those killed were civilians. As far as the argument that if we didn't supply them, others would, honestly should remove the full stop and continue. But if you imagine we're never given them the chance, you must be bloody joking. As a consequence of three decades spent in close scrutiny of the wheeling and dealing, conniving and cheating, bribing and blackmailing, which constitutes the armaments industry, you see before you a deeply cynical man. Someone who is convinced, without having any evidence, that General Custer had shares in the musket industry, Cassius in daggers, and David, goddammit, in slingshots. I confess that I find it difficult to distinguish the ethics of Swiss manufacturers designing, building, and supplying the first mobile gas chambers for Nazi Germany, and Gallenkamp and Co. of Loughborough, England, a subsidiary of Plessons, the fertilizer and garden people, supplying key ingredients for the manufacture of the lethal nerve gas sarin to the Pinochet dictatorship, which subsequently were exported to Iraq. It was, of course, at a fertilizer plant that the first G agents, sarin, Soman, and Tabor, were produced in Iraq, and currently at another plant near Samarra. Chemicals may seem a particularly pernicious export, but again, personally, I find it difficult to distinguish between supplying chemicals or the components facilitating the production of nuclear weapons. Of the two nuclear reactors at present in Iraq, one was supplied from France, the other from the USSR. It's a very democratic business, the arms business. And of course, they have also acquired quantities of uranium. Whenever you hear the hypocritical chorus castigating the butcher Saddam or the evil Khomeini, remember these facts. Of the two occasions post-World War II when the arms trade was in a comparative slump in 1970 and at the beginning of the 80s, it was a spectacular surge in trading with Middle Eastern regimes that proved the salvation of these manufacturers. The Shah of Iran, most notably, had a voracious appetite for weaponry. Between 1973 and 1974, the Pentagon's foreign sales more than doubled from $3.9 billion to $8.3 billion. And of this, half was down to the good old Shah. And the advertising at this time, if I may show you some, was particularly vomit-inducing. This one, here is one from Phillips, which was in an Iran newspaper, and I'll read you the groveling translation. The Iranian subsidiary of Phillips wishes to express its endless gratitude to His Royal Majesty, the Shah of Iran, who has, with the proclamation of the Iranian Resurrection Party, secured the unity of the nation. Well, they got that one, didn't they? But never mind. And here is another one. This was from a EMI brochure, and this is a bit more down to earth. It says, EMI Ranger Anti-Personnel Mine-Laying System. So when you're blown up, boys, remember where these good old mines came from. And during the Iran-Iraq War, which now lasted 7 years, and let me remind you of the terrible suffering that that inflicted. In that 7 years war, 350,000 people were killed, and 650,000 were wounded, and countless millions of lives were plumbed into the even greater depths of misery than that which they already knew. During this war, a perfect illustration of this democracy in the armaments business, which I spoke of, 27 civilized governments supplied arms to both sides. including, of course, jolly old democratic United Kingdom. I'm sure that you would be surprised and upset to learn that despite the Operation Staunch set up by the Pentagon in 1983 to stop the supply of arms to Iran by Western governments, Her Majesty's government was host to numerous arms for oil discount deals through the good offices of the National Iranian Oil Company, which housed also the Logistics Support Center. I love these little names they give themselves. And conveniently, of course, for all these deals was situated right opposite the House of Commons. It was not closed until 1987, conveniently the very year in which that terrible war came to an end. During this shattering war, the major supplier of arms to Iran were China and Russia and the United Kingdom. The major suppliers to Iraq were China and Russia and France. And let us never forget that it was the Western powers who encouraged Iraq to attack Iran in the first place. In the full knowledge, of course, of the systematic repression by that regime of the Kurdish population. Nor should we forget that when the US government feared that Iraq might lose, it actually stepped in with military support. And nor should we forget that Mrs. Thatcher substantially increased export credit guarantees to Iraq as a reward for his efforts. And what is the result to Iraq of all this? Well, today, Iraq, as a result of this war, has a debt amounting to $85 billion. And we wonder why there are desperate men in control. And to bring things right up to date, the 13 UK exhibitors, led by British Aerospace, were forceful exhibitors at the Baghdad Arms Fair. Unfortunately, I could not obtain in time any copies of the advertisements that went round that fair, but I am assured from the highest and most reliable sources that they were equally, if not more, grovelling than the one concerning the Shah. Not one of the wars fought in my lifetime have been a consequence of anything but the ruthless pursuit of power and profit within a stupid and corrupt economic system. The focal point of a socialist revolution must be a clear opposition to that system and solidarity with victims of oppression everywhere. Only by the consistent and democratic presentation of the case for socialism, respecting the intelligence of our fellow workers, can we hasten the day when words like war and capitalism are confined to dusty, out-of-date dictionaries and no part of any sensible vocabulary. And amazement will be expressed that anyone should ever have been dark enough to be participants in either. I have here supplied to me a most heartening cut from a newspaper speaking of the rebellion amongst some of the armed forces in America against this war. And I'm only going to quote you a short bit at the end. It says, the most outspoken objection so far is from Marine Corporal Jeffrey Patterson in Hawaii, who said he would not fight for American profits and cheap oil, and is now in a military prison for refusing to go to the Middle East. Amongst my vast and largely boring reading of these military documents and tomes, occasionally I find something that causes me a mild amount of amusement. Unbelievably, there was a Pentagon document that came to my notice which took 6 pages defining the specification of a whistle. Recently, I had occasion to come across an even more sensational one which took 200 pages to define the making of a Christmas cake. Ladies and gentlemen, comrades and friends, it is my deepest wish that the next time, ere long, taking the example from men like Mr. Patterson, when the flags are waved and the whistles are blown, they'll tell them what to do with their sobbing whistles and where to put their rotten Christmas cake.